Hi everyone, it's Fareed again, your host for Inside Graphic Novels, where we take you right to the people that make graphic novels interesting, the people, the artists, the writers, the stories. We bring it all to you in this very, very special podcast that we set up a couple months back through the whole Corona crisis, and hoping to bring a smile and get people excited about reading while they're stuck at home. So thanks so much for listening, and I'm going to be doing something completely different this time around. We're going to have a guest on the show. So sit back, relax, and enjoy this. Hi, everybody, and welcome back to another episode on the pod for Inside Graphic Novels. I'm really, really excited about a very special guest joining us for this issue, for this episode, and his name is Michael. And without giving away any more, I'm just going to hand it straight over to him and ask for one of those super in-depth introductions. So, Michael, welcome to the pod.
Hi, thank you, Fareed. I appreciate you inviting me to be a part of this. I'm a fan of your podcast. I've listened to every episode so far. It's informative, and I love the titles that you select as well. So I am excited to be part of this. My name is Michael Gianfrancisco, and I am a high school English teacher and sometimes adjunct professor of English in the Rhode Island area, Rhode Island, USA, of course, New England. The high school I teach at is North Providence High School, which is just outside of our capital city of Providence. And I sometimes adjunct at Johnson & Wales University, which has campuses not just in Rhode Island, but other parts of the country. But I teach at the Down City campus in Providence from time to time. I'm also one of the founding members of a teacher cohort called LitX, which is a group of educators that focus on using 21st century texts in the classroom, kind of breaking away from the traditional books, poetry, short stories. But we use those texts, of course, but we also encourage and help other teachers use things like comics and graphic novels, music, video games, film, that kind of stuff. So we believe the X in LitX is a variable, and that literature can be anything. If it's a story, you can teach it. So we do a lot of work, outreach work, especially not recently because of the pandemic, obviously, but we travel around the country and go to Comic-Cons and to educational conferences and do panels and workshops teaching teachers how to teach with these texts.
That's so awesome. That's so awesome, yeah. Michael. I'm such a big fan of that. And I know that you have a super interesting story when it comes to how you've taken, and by the way, just for our listeners, Michael and I first actually met on the internet on Twitter. And so Michael, I do want you to share your Twitter handle with all of our listeners just so that they can hopefully follow you and enjoy some of the same content that I've had the privilege of enjoying over the last couple of weeks.
Yeah, my Twitter handle is @TryingTeacher, T-R-Y-I-N-G, teacher, all one word. You can also follow the cohort at WeAreLitX, WeAreLitX.
Incredible. So it's a bunch of teachers fighting for education using different media like graphic novels. Is that right?
Well, I wouldn't say fighting anymore. I think while there is still pockets of resistance to using comics in the classroom, I think that fight has been dutifully won. Yay. Not by me per se, but by educators around the world that awesome. Have already pulled these texts out of their own personal collections and shared them with their students. So what we try to do is we're taking it to the next level. Instead of just teaching, you know, showing teachers, hey, look, this is a graphic novel. Look how great it is. Most educators today, you know, this new generation of Gen X educators and Gen Y and Gen Z educators that are coming up the pipe now grew up on comics like I did. And what we're doing now is showing them practical strategies and methodologies for using comics in the classroom and film and video games and card games and all that kind of stuff. We could focus this conversation on comics, of course, but that's what we're looking for. Like, we try to build out the professional development that we ourselves want. So like when I put together a set of panels with my team, I want to attend them as much as I want to participate in them. You know, I don't want to just be there, present. We build out panels of things like I don't know about, so we can find experts that can show us. And we've been very successful. You know, we presented in New York at New York Comic Con. We've done panels for San Diego Comic Con. We've done panels for the American Library Association, for National Council of Teachers of English. We've done panels in Denver Comic Con, C2E2 in Chicago, in Seattle, in Philadelphia. So, you know, we just keep doing it. And we're doing panels, virtual panels this summer for Comic Cons that are going online. So, we're doing the best we can, and I think people get it. It's just now they're not sure what to do with the books, so that's what we're trying to do.
Well, let's give them something to talk about and hopefully use in their classrooms. So thank you again, Michael, for joining us on the pod. And when we come back, we're gonna get straight into this beautiful little number that Michael found and recommended, and I'm super excited to share this with you. So stick with us. Welcome back, everyone, and we are with Michael again on a very, very special episode, as I said before, and I think it's special primarily because we're going to be touching on a very specific graphic novel, and I'm going to say comic, and we're probably going to have a short discussion on what makes what in just a second, but I think I'd like Michael to actually introduce the title, and perhaps, Michael, what we can do is have a little conversation about, you know, why we chose it and what it means for today's audience. So why don't I hand it over to you, Michael?
Sure. So the book that one of the books that I suggested that we ended up settling on was a book called Superman Smashes the Klan. It's a DC comics for kids or teens book. DC's got a couple of new imprints and they're releasing books, retelling stories or recreating key characters in more of a YA kind of format, single issue, you know, single contained stories. It's written by Gene Yang, who anybody who knows graphic novels knows American-born Chinese. Boxers and Saints is one of his other books. Dragon Hoops is one of his newer books. And the art is by the studio Gurihiro, a Japanese partnership of two women who are artists who operate under that name. So the book is set, it's set in 1946. So you're in the golden age of comics version of Superman, where he can't fly or use, you know, any of his weird powers other than strength and his ability to run really fast. Like, he doesn't have X-ray vision yet. He doesn't have his heat vision. This is the Superman we remember from 1938, the early Superman that could leap tall buildings. He didn't fly. And it takes place in Metropolis, back in the 40s. And it touches on a number of issues like racism, and identity and family. And there's a lot packed into what seems, from just glancing at it, to be what would be like a simple YA story, but it's anything but.
So, Michael, why is it a graphic novel, or is it a comic? And I think we always have these discussions with so many people about, you know, titles like Persepolis or all these other comic books and graphic novels on where's the line? What distinguishes one from the other? And actually, why are we so precious about that difference? So can we have a quick conversation about that? Because sometimes, I guess, the delineation is pretty clear in my head, but I've struggled to perhaps articulate it. And it would be great, I guess, to hear from you as an educator and as a connoisseur, you know, what's what for you?
Well, you know what? I don't have strong feelings either way about this question. I get it a lot, you know, people ask all the time, particularly when we're doing educational panels and shows and stuff, or just in general, when we're talking to educators or fans about. I think the terms can be used interchangeably. I'm not gonna, you know, put my flag in the ground either way on this, to be honest with you, because I think the question is, for me personally, I consider a standalone story a graphic novel. So, you know, like a trade paperback of a 6-issue run of a continuing series would be a graphic novel to me. I'm not saying that that's the hard and fast definition. I'm just saying to me. Whereas when I think comics, personally, I think the floppy single issue books that you get in the comic book shop that are, you know, you collect them month by month, issue by issue. I've spoken to many artists and creators in the many years that I've been doing this work. And usually they kind of say comics and graphic novels are essentially the same, or that graphic novels are a more academic way to describe comic books, because, you know, books, a lot of graphic novels aren't funny because comic invokes the idea of funny, but that's not also necessarily a way to define it. So quite honestly, I use the term pretty interchangeably. Sequential art is another one that comes up when we describe these types of books.
Sure.
So, you know, for me, it's more about appreciating the book itself than worrying about what we should call it.
I think that's probably a great way of looking at it. My personal view has always been that, you know, both graphic novels and comics straddle, as I said, a thin line. And for me, it's really about just appreciating the story and not making too much of a big deal about which one is what. But it's also, I think there is this perhaps impression that a comic is supposed to be funny. Maybe it's inherently in the word comic itself. And whereas, of course, a lot of the more serious tomes that we read today that are graphic novels that could span, let's say, I don't know, and again, the second part of it being novel, usually in my mind inspires this or conjures up an image of something that is much heftier, you know, is a longer read. So that's kind of how I used to look at it, but it's interesting to hear your perspective. So just coming back to the book and why we chose this specific title, because I mean, Superman is not a new construct, right? I mean, it first came out in 1938, and he's been going strong, right? There isn't anything that Superman hasn't touched. He's been in radio shows, and he's been on TV, in movies. So what makes this so special?
I think that this is a kind of a classic look at a hero that everybody knows. And I think that's part of the reason why I think it would be really effective in the classroom, because one of the struggles as an educator, when you bring this medium to your students, especially if you bring a superhero book, the kids that would normally not pick up a comic or a graphic novel on their own are more likely to buy in if you hand them a book with a hero that they recognize.
Sure.
Unfortunately, today's modern media has given us a lot of those because of the films and television shows and streaming network shows and stuff that have been, you know, like The Flash and Arrow, and then the Marvel Cinematic Universe and the DC Cinematic Universe and the CW DC Universe and you know all the stuff on Netflix and Hulu and Amazon. So there are more of these heroes, but the one that I think everybody knows is Superman. So if I hand a kid a book that has Superman on the cover, they're already going in with at least a partial buy-in that, okay, I know this. It's not like I'm handing them some vague, you know, superhero book that's either they've never seen before or is some deep canonical you have to understand all the stuff about the past of this particular, you know, character in order to really get it. All you need to know about Superman is that, you know, he's truth, justice, leaps tall buildings in a single bound, more powerful than a locomotive. That's all you need to know. Even the additional powers that we know Superman has, he doesn't have in this book, at least not initially. So I think it's very accessible, and I think that's unnecessary, and it's also part of the development of the character through the book. So that's where, what I think there.
I think one of the really interesting themes at play here throughout this particular piece of work is the immigrant narrative. And I don't just mean the Chinese American family that's in the story, but of course here I refer to Superman himself as somebody who is an alien or an illegal alien, perhaps even an immigrant into this world. How do you feel students or readers relate to that concept as sort of a parallel between the story of the Chinese American family and Superman? Do you think that that's come off well in the story itself?
Oh, absolutely. I think one thing that Gene Yang understands is culture and culture shock and the idea of becoming part of a world that you are not, how do I put this? The idea of immigration and not just, you know, coming in from another country. They move from another part of this country where they were living in a Chinatown part of the U.S., you know, and they were surrounded by other Chinese Americans, and they moved to metropolis and they live among a far less diverse group. You know, they are the only Chinese people in the area that they live. So I think with taking Superman and creating that juxtaposition of the other and the idea of immigration and cultural, becoming accepted within, you know, part of a larger group of people. Superman doesn't know where he's from at the beginning of this book. So it's very obvious that there is a symbolic parallel between his story and the story of the Chinese American family. So, and how he develops and why he isn't able to do all the things that we expect him to be able to do is because, as part of the story, he's holding himself back because he wants to fit in. He wants to suppress the parts of himself that make him more different. He's already different because he's stronger and faster.
Michael, that's super informative, and I feel that the entire book is actually part of my favorite subject, history. I've learned so much by reading the book, and I've enjoyed so much the whole sort of moving back and forth on the timeline between the 1940s and the 1930s. It just feels so accurate, feels very very real. So I'd love to, I mean, clearly neither of us have lived back in time, but it would be great to hear from you on how you feel the narrative moves back and forth, but more importantly on the importance of the historical backdrop and how active perhaps the Klan was back then, and also very importantly why the Klan wasn't referred to as the Ku Klux Klan in the actual book itself. So please tell me more about what you thought about the time continuum.
It's unfortunate that this, you know, so many things like this in the country's history have happened, but you know, as we move forward, it's important to continuously look at where we've been in order to ensure that we don't make those mistakes again. So this book takes us back, you know, some, you know, 70 something years, 80 years, and kind of asks the question of what would it be like if if a group that is modeled, this group is not the Ku Klux Klan, it's the Knights of the, what do they call it? The Knights of the Klan, Knights of the Burning Cross.
That's
with a
right.
K,
that's right.
Something like that. So it's they're just an, you know, they're just a placeholder.
It's the Clan of the Fiery Cross. That's the name.
Knights of the Clan of the Fiery Cross. Yeah.
Gosh,
so you know, it's pretty clear who they are. I mean, they're wearing the same garments, sheets, and stuff that you see in those old KKK photos and videos and movies and stuff. And they burn crosses on the lawns of the Chinese American family. So it's pretty clear who they are and they're supposed to represent. And I think
But Michael, can I just interrupt you for a second? Is that narrative understood in America? Do people understand? Because I certainly didn't when I read this book. I didn't have a feel that on the West Coast in California, it was more the Chinese ethnic groups that were targeted. Because I, very often, and I relate to this entirely being an immigrant, and my family had immigrated to Canada, so I very much relate to this. Not with the level of discrimination, certainly, but at least from the story of most immigrant groups don't look at racism against Black people as racism against them. So it really doesn't become a problem for them until it happens to them. But here, it's the Chinese diaspora or the Chinese ethnicity that's, I guess, being discriminated against. And I found that incredibly informative because I just didn't know that that was a thing that was happening back in the U.S. at that time.
Well, you know, you're talking about post-World War II, and if you read George Takei's book, They Called Us Enemy, which is about his true story about his family being put in an internment camp in the U.S. After the Pearl Harbor bombings.
That's right, man.
In World War II.
Yeah.
It's another amazing book that touches on the nature of racism and racist policies. And it's a true story. It's George's true story. So
And this
it's
is
important.
This is the guy who was in Star Wars, Star Trek. Sorry,
yeah.
Right?
Star Trek, yeah, he was Sulu in Star Trek, but he's now an activist, very active, especially on social media, for not just civil rights, but also for LGBTQ issues.
Incredible.
And rights. So I had the opportunity to meet him at a Comic-Con a couple years ago, and he's
wow.
amazing. He and his husband Brad are just two just superstars in the world of activism. And his book is just fantastic. So, but I think, yeah, Gene, a lot of Gene's books deal with that idea as well. If you've read American Born Chinese, it talks a lot about being an American, Chinese American.
Sure.
And it's multiple stories that come together in a single narrative. Boxers and Saints talks about a period in history in China that I think a lot of people really don't understand and don't realize happened.
Mm.
And he touches on the idea of race in Dragon Hoops, his newest book. And there's others too that he's done. He did the relaunch of the Superman, the Chinese Superman for DC a few years back as well. He wrote those books. So he really does put a heavy microscope to the idea of racism towards Chinese Americans, Japanese Americans, Korean Americans, I think the history is important that the KKK did not just target African Americans. So they targeted, Asian Americans, and they targeted Latinos. This story, when you see the word Klan, you expect it to be, and there is an African American character, several, but there's a very important one. The chief, one of the police detectives is African American. So there's that dynamic as well happening here, because he is also a target by this version of the Klan. So there's a lot going on in this book,
I think that's absolutely true. There is a lot going on in the book. I mean, I just on some counts, I mean, we were looking back, there is racism and not just racism, but there's also anti-Semitism, very clear, moments where you see that happening. But there are also these, rare moments of unity, right? Where you see, for example, the rabbi together with the priests and, bringing the community together. So it's interesting how you have these two forces pulling society apart at the seams, or bringing them back together again. And I'm keen to sort of also hear your point of view on, what that must be like in schools that you teach in. I don't know how diverse the school is that you're in, but I'd love to hear more about that. But also, again, just coming back to the book, whether you feel that as the reader is taken through the story, you feel that there is that coming together of the community and coming together of people through, I guess, a beautifully illustrated comic.
Yeah, the book doesn't pull any punches when it comes to those themes, I think. And that's what I like about it, is they're accessible, but they're serious. It's treated with a great deal of respect. But also it is written from the perspective of a young, a YA person. Like the kids in the story are kind of our point of view. We do follow Superman, but we're really, the story is really about the two siblings.
So do you feel, Michael, that the book itself, I mean, there is clearly quite a lot that the book's taken on, in the sense that there is clearly racism, there's anti-Semitism, there's sexism, and the immigrant other. I mean, how much more can you roll into one story? And what I'm interested in is, there are, of course, those rare moments of unity that you see through the book as well, where, you see the rabbi and the priest, and they're trying to create this place, a safe space for kids to be together. And how much of that do you think is a story told well in terms of the community mending? And I clearly see, within the characters as well, that there's a great deal of a push and pull between the younger characters and how they're grappling with this very difficult, racist theme. And especially one character in particular, who is a young boy whose uncle is a senior member of the Klan, and how he's torn, really torn, between supporting his family and the ideals that they have, and how many young people must have that at home, right? Where they're hearing things from the people that they love, but those things aren't right. They're not the right things to say or do. And how much of that do you see happening in the U.S. today? How do you feel? Do you think that the graphic novel touches a nerve?
I think it does. I mean, I can't pretend like I see everything. And I grew up in a household that was reasonably progressive, I would say. While I recognize what racism is, and I recognize that we all have to be cognizant of our thoughts and our feelings and how we express them. So what I think this book does with that idea of unity, and particularly the character that you mentioned, whose uncle is a Klan member, who's trying to indoctrinate the younger, his nephew into the group. Even though the nephew has mixed feelings about it, he's struggling with whether or not he, wants to participate. He's got a lot of confusion and anger, and young people tend to be confused about the world, particularly when they reach adolescence, which is the target audience for this book. So, the kid is a really big fan of Superman. And when Superman says, the Klan is bad, the kid is like, oh my God, like what, I have to decide between this individual that I idolize and my entire family and what they believe, but I also have to do what's right, because he becomes friends with the kids. So I think what the story for me, and I'm not going to be the only person, I'm not the expert who comes up with the one answer here, but for me, it makes me feel like the book is saying that each new generation has an opportunity to step forward away from the racism of the past and the things that always were, you know, this is how it's always been and how it always should be. And with each passing generation, and they can carry new ideas and broader ideas and more open minds forward to create a world where, you know, people can be accepted, not accepted. I mean, just everybody can just live their lives and not look at one another and say, let's judge each other on our differences. Instead, let's just judge each other on, you know, the content of our character. And I think that's what happens with that character in this book, is that he recognizes what's right. When Superman realizes, and he tells everybody, I'm from another planet, he puts himself out there. He's just like, the world doesn't know, and he doesn't know where he came from. And he says, I'm from another planet. That's why I'm different. That's who I am. And I'm part of this world, you know. And when that happens, that gives kind of sends the shockwaves through the rest of the characters. Not all of them, you know, make the right decisions in the end, but we are left with an optimistic future, you know. So that's, I think that's kind of, you know, the young people of the world are the ones that are fight hardest for change, because they're inheriting the world. Totally. So I think that's what this is trying, I think partly trying to kind of impress upon readers.
For sure. And I think that, you know, if any of us were to get inspired by teenagers and young people and the next generation, I mean, even if you take a look back in history, Superman as a concept was actually created by two teenagers, right? So that's still very much and what's interesting to me is that these two teenagers, you know, Jerry Siegel and Joe Shuster, were children of first generation Americans, you know, sons to Jewish immigrants into the United States. And I think that must have informed so much of the Superman, you know, identity, right? And I think that their choice to actually fight the Klan through soft power in a comic book or graphic novel is so culturally important, because I think, again, the author towards the back of the comic book gives you a really incredible history lesson in why that was important for them to do, and how it all started off in radio. By the way, Michael, this might be another aside, but I don't think I saw radio in there. There was a lot of, you know, the golden age of newspapers, because of course that's the Daily Planet and we're talking about Superman. But did you see any radio happen in the actual graphic novel or the comic?
I don't really remember that, to be honest with you. I don't think so.
Because is kind of where this, that's where this whole story originated, right? So it was actually a radio story. And I can totally understand that, because my grandmother, I remember telling me very clearly that a lot of the programming, of course, you used to come on the radio and, you know, they would gather together, they'd sit down in front of the radio and they would listen. And this is, of course, you know, even we're talking about pre-partition India, 1947, right? But so I can just imagine that back then in the US, it must have been a similar sort of family activity where people would get together, there'd be a radio, you'd sit down and you'd listen to Superman taking down the Klan, which is fascinating for me. But one other thing I find fascinating culturally, and I'd love to get your thoughts on this again, it is this whole feeling that to fit in, people have to change their names. Because I find it fascinating, because again, coming from an Asian background, but specifically, I think people from the subcontinent haven't really changed their names. You know, if somebody was called, you know, Deepak, they'd be called Deepak. If it was Imran, it'd be Imran. You can see the best example, I guess, would be Hasan Minhaj on Netflix with the Patriot Act. But with a lot of Chinese immigrants and I guess Asian immigrants, Far East Asian immigrants, you would see that changing of the name happen from, you know, Chung Min to some, like, I don't know, Charles or something of that sort. And you see that happening again in the story, in this particular story. Now, do you feel that that's changed in America today? Do you think that people need, or do you still see that that need by immigrants to sort of change, to feel like they need to fit in?
I mean, I can't say that I see it that often where I am. I think I have had students particularly college students, kids who are immigrating from China and coming to the university, who on paper have a Chinese name, but then choose a more Anglicanized name or American name.
Sure.
For the purposes of, you know, I don't know. I mean, personally, I don't, if that makes them feel more comfortable,
yes,
then that's their, I would say that would should be their decision to decide whether or not they want to take on a different name.
I think it is entirely somebody's choice and how they feel comfortable. But I think that that comfort turns to discomfort in the story with one of the heroes, the hero's sister, who is actually, I think, in reality, the real heroine of the entire graphic novel is this young Chinese American girl. She cringes at many points where her brother tries to fit in, and that fitting in is about, you know, deprecating humor about your own culture, which in this case, of course, is Chinese culture. And, you know, I'm curious, and I'm always fascinated by the lengths that people would go to try and fit in. And I think, again, the author has just done an incredible job of capturing that. So there are definitely moments which made me cringe, for sure.
Yeah, like just from the very beginning, the father is really adamant about this family being as, you know, quote, American as possible. Like, he wants them to speak English even when they're just together alone.
Sure.
You know, and I think the son also, he doesn't want to focus on anything that makes him feel different than the other kids. He's a great baseball player. And that's how he gets kind of accepted by the boys right off the bat, no pun intended, is that he, you know, he's a great player. He's a great pitcher.
Yeah.
So he wins over the team in that moment, but is willing to concede a number of things that his sister is not, in terms of just, you know, overlooking things in order to be accepted, which parallels Superman's story in that he is, again, like I said before, he's suppressing these powers that he could be using subconsciously or consciously because he does not want to be more different than he already is. And in fact, when he sees his parents in visions, which I think is very interesting. Actually, I would love to get your impression of this part of the book, is his parents look almost like 1950s aliens when he sees them kind of manifest, you know, his parents from the planet, you know,
Krypton.
Yeah. So he sees them as green, pointy-eared aliens until he completely accepts his past and where he is origin. And then when he sees them for the last time, you know, and he goes to the Fortress of Solitude, or, you know, what is essentially the Fortress of Solitude, he sees them and they look like he does. They look like him. You
that's
know?
Fascinating. It's fascinating because I totally agree. I think that's definitely a journey that Superman is on in this graphic novel, a journey of acceptance and a journey that helps him embrace his past and perhaps reconcile it with his future and his present. So it's a powerful bit of storytelling and very, very well illustrated. I think the bugs just make it feel so alien. And I'm sure when our listeners actually do grab a copy and read it, they'll kind of see where we're coming from. But on that note, I think it brings me back to something that I think is so important, in that this graphic novel has actually been drawn by the art duo, and you mentioned this earlier, Michael, Gurihiro, and actually that is simply a collective pseudonym or a collective name for these two Japanese women who are just incredible artists and have been behind hits like The Last Airbender, etc. So when you're reading this graphic novel, you'll see a lot of it feels very manga-esque, right? Like that typical sort of post-apocalyptic sort of, you can't tell whether they're Western or Asian characters. There's some sort of meld of the two in between. And you see that very, very much, even in the lead heroine, the girl, the young Chinese girl, she looks very, you know, sort of European-esque in some scenes. So I find that sort of it's fascinating how Japanese artists have really made that their own thing, and how that the manga stroke, you know, sort of Asian flair for that kind of artwork comes across throughout the comic book and is being captured so brilliantly without losing, of course, the fact that this is a Superman story. So I think that's really interesting, because obviously many of us who have read Superman expect to see much more that photorealism or that art style that was more akin to what we're used to with Batman, etc. So I don't know how you felt about that, Michael, but I really enjoyed it.
Yeah, I think the art makes this book infinitely more accessible.
Totally.
I think this is a book that you can put into the hands of a middle school student. I mean, all the way up to an adult will see this. It's colorful. It's the panel layout is tremendous. It's very impactful. Some of the sequences and facial expressions are very robust. The character designs are very strong. I think that from cover to cover, the artistry of this book is just a wonder to behold. I really mean, and some of the splash pages as well, particularly this, you know, Superman at one, like he can't fly yet, he didn't read the story. So he has to run carrying the kids under his arms at one point in the story. And that's uncomfortable for them, right? Because some big guy picked you up when you were like 13 years old or 12 years old and ran through the woods with you, it would be pretty bumpy. But that's also necessary because, you know, the heroine of the story, she realizes that Superman is holding himself back because of the way she said she feels the motion of his running and when he lands.
Yeah.
She senses that. She's like, are you sure you're not kind of flying when you run? You know, because you kind of landed, you slowed your landing down. Like, how do you do that if you're just running? So it's like, she's somebody that is very comfortable with who she is and is not willing to compromise on her identity to please her parents, to please the people around her, to please the other children, even her brother. And Superman is the opposite. And she helps him kind of come to terms with that by saying, look, I see you're holding yourself back. You can be who you are, and you'll be stronger if you do that. And
totally.
Emotionally, and for him, he's able to fly. He can use his other powers. Like he can use his cold breath and his heat vision, all the things that we love about Superman. He isn't able to do that till he accepts himself.
True.
Who he is, where he came from, and his place in this world. And the world accepts him, not entirely. This dissension, you notice at the beginning when he tells everybody who he is, where he's from, there's a lot of people who are afraid. You know, the other, you know, that idea of, you know, xenophobia.
Someone different than me. Absolutely. That comes across really well. No, I think the fact that you see everybody from Lana Lang to, you know, Lois Lane to the landmarks of that period, whether it's Daily Planet or Smallville, like they really hit it out of the ballpark with you could probably pick up this book, not have any exposure to Superman, and I'm going to go out on a limb and say this, and really figure out the whole story. That to me is very special, because I think this is going to introduce an entire generation of readers to the, you know, to the Man of Steel.
Yeah, and it's interesting. The first time we see him, he's fighting a Nazi super soldier who refers to him as the Superman.
Yes, that was fantastic.
So, I mean, there's just little for the history person in you, who recognizes some of what is being invoked there in those moments. It's really, like I said, it's really something how they managed to put together such a really cool and impactful and very, like I said before, very serious, very reverent story that is, while it takes place in the 40s, or it's set in the 40s, is super relevant today.
I love how you said that. It is definitely super relevant. And so thank you so much, Michael, for just working through that with me, because you've helped me appreciate it even better. And when we come back, we're going to take a step aside from the book and just talk a little bit about the really important work that you're doing with so many people, including the Comic Cons and with teachers and educators, all about using some of these great tools in schools. So bear with us as we take a short break and come right back. So now that we've talked about Superman Smashes the Clan, and hopefully we haven't spoiled it for our listeners, because we talked about so many things that have happened, and I promise you, readers and listeners, I'm just kidding. There's just so much in there. Clearly, you just need to pick up a copy and go through it, and I'm sure you'll come away with maybe even more than what we've just talked about, because there's so many levels to this book. And again, as I said, if you are a history buff and you love comics, this just sets an entirely new paradigm in terms of how important being an anti-racist is today. And there's no anti-racist better than Superman. So coming away from the book for a second, Michael, I know, again, we spoke about this briefly at the beginning of the show, but you do an incredible amount of work with educators and with people from the comic book industry. Can you tell me a little bit more about that role that you've played in terms of bridging those two? Because they seem like wildly distant in my eyes. And also, I would love for you to tell me a little bit more about this crazy conference that you planned and are planning. Tell me a little bit more about the journey, Michael.
Well, you know, I was loving comics when I was a kid. I had Peanuts collections that I read when I was a kid. And when I was, you know, old enough to go to the library on my own, there was a library just a couple of blocks from my house growing up, I would spend most of my time in the section where they had the collected editions of the old Marvel and DC books. So the old first few issues of like Avengers and Captain America and Batman, Spider-Man and Superman and Wonder Woman. So, you know, it wasn't like it is now where we had all these trade paperbacks and the Barnes and Noble had shelves of them. Like, there wasn't that much of it out there, but I gravitated towards it growing up. And then I started collecting issue by issue books, going to the comic book store every Wednesday for New Comic Day in Providence and picking up new books with friends. And as I got older, the medium kind of grew up with me. So, you know, we started to see more of those independent underground comics become more mainstream, like Mouse, Watchmen, not that Watchmen's underground, but you know what I mean. Persepolis, books like that started to appear in the 70s and 80s and into the 90s, and the themes and the nature of the stories of these books started to get more mature, and then more independent artists started throwing their hat into the ring, and we started to see more and more memoir type stories, which I really love, and science fiction stories that aren't necessarily superhero tales and historical dramas. And, you know, suddenly the medium started to explode. And when I went to school to become a teacher, my comic collection was pretty robust by that point. And I really felt like I wanted to share that. So when I student taught, my professor, her name was Dr. Jennifer Cook. She was a professor, one of my professors, there were a couple. And I brought this box of graphic novels to class, and I said, I'd like to try these with my students as student teaching. And she really liked, you know, she was always already kind of into graphic novels, and she saw what I had and she really liked them. So we, you know, she said, go for it. So I did, and the kids really gravitated to it. I didn't know what I was doing with the books at the time. I just brought a box in and said, pick something and read it, and let's see what we can make from this. So it worked. And then when I became a full-time teacher the following year, I started building more and more lessons around sequential art and graphic novels and comics in the classroom. Although it was less, you know, I started out, I wasn't doing as much, but a couple of years into my teaching, Jen, Dr. Cook, came to me and said, hey, there's a conference on campus, my alma mater, Rhode Island College, there's a conference on campus for young adult literature. Do you want to present with me graphic novels? And we did. We did it, and it was one of the most popular panels of the day. Standing room only in the room, people wanted to stay and read the books and talk to us. So we said, I think we got something here, you know, and I'm working in a vacuum, remember, because this is like before the internet was super huge. It was big, but it wasn't super big. And there were no avenues for any of this for teachers. So it was just kind of like me. And then now and then I get a professional development where you'd go somewhere and you'd sit in a room for 6 hours with teachers and there'd be somebody presenting. And I went to one, it was a librarian, and he said, here's graphic novels. And he just did this long PowerPoint showing all different titles. And I'm like, okay, I've read that. So partway through I said, so how do you teach? He's like, I'm a librarian. I just want to show you the books. Most people in the room were like just astonished that these books existed. Me, I knew they existed. I needed to know how to use them. So knowing that I didn't have any real help that way, I started developing lessons on my own and slowly building kind of a binder, if you will, digital and literal binder of lessons for how to use different comics in different places in my teaching. Jen and I presented again in New York a year later, and it was a conference dedicated specifically to comics in the classroom. It was fun, and we had a good time going out to New York together and doing it, but then the following year, they didn't bring it back. So Jen and I went to her, I said, why don't we do our own conference? So we planned it, and it was 2011, March 2011, the New England Comic Arts in the Classroom Conference, NECAC, NECAC is what we called it. And it was a small conference, but it filled up very quickly. We had 120 attendees because that was the most we could fit in the biggest room we had. Raina Tegelmeyer, who you know from Smile and Sisters and Drama and Guts, was our keynote. We had people contacting us from publishing houses, artists, agents. Can we send this person? Can we send you books? Can we sponsor you? And it was an amazing success that one day. We had breakout sessions and workshops and panel discussions and keynotes and end notes and lunch notes. And it was just a fully packed day, and people just really loved it. And so we, after it was done, we said, okay, let's take a break. And I was finishing my master's degree, and Jen was one of my master's advisors. And I said, well, when I finish this master's, let's talk about doing this again. She said, we'll do another conference. But unfortunately, a few months before my master's was to be finished, there was an accident. Jen was killed in a tragic accident. And the wind kind of went out of my sails in terms of putting on my own conference at that point. And I felt brokenhearted, for so many reasons. And I just kind of plodded on for a while. And I was lucky enough to get connected with different organizations and large comic conferences, programming teams. And I started submitting and doing workshops with conferences like New York Comic Con, San Diego Comic Con, C2E2 in Chicago, Emerald City Comic Con, Denver Comic Con, Rhode Island Comic Con here in my own home state, Keystone Comic Con in Philadelphia, Wildcat Comic Con in Pennsylvania. We even had a friend, another teacher in our cohort who put on a conference for us at Motor City Comic Con in Detroit. So, that's kind of what I've been doing, plus NCTE and ALA, like I mentioned before. So I'm through all of this time, I connected with all these other teachers, a group of teachers in Chicago, a couple of teachers in California, New York City, St. Louis, Florida. And we started talking about kind of just having a cohort together of teachers who love comics in the classroom, and that's where LitX was born. And we're still doing that. We just recorded two panels for the San Diego Comic-Con International Comic-Con at Home. They're gonna drop on the 22nd, Wednesday the 22nd, two LitX panels there. We just did one for, we organized one for Keystone Comic-Con, Reed Pop, who runs New York and Chicago and Emerald City and Keystone, put on a Pride Fest, and we did a panel for them, education in comics for Pride Fest for them. And who knows, we're supposed to do a couple at NCTE, which doesn't seem to be happening right now because of the pandemic, but we will likely be doing something, recording panels and submitting them to NCTE if that's what they want. So we'll see. But that's kind of been my journey. And now, what we announced very recently is that LitX is going back to Rhode Island College to do another NECAC-type conference I've already kind of connected with the groups there. The pandemic has slowed everything down, but we're hoping to do it in the fall of 2021 in Rhode Island at Rhode Island College, in conjunction working with the Rhode Island Writing Project, who are an affiliate of the National Writing Project. So that's something that's in the works, and we're hoping that we can get the pandemic under control, we can get to work on that. So that's the plan as of right now. So that's a lot, I'm sorry, but
no, that's more than a lot, Michael. That's just incredible. That's, in fact, that's super. The fact that you are building bridges, you are helping so many other teachers discover the love of using this really amazing medium in helping people understand what I would consider to be fairly difficult subjects to teach through any other medium, whether it's because it's just not engaging enough or because it's just too harsh. You think about tackling racism with real videos, I mean, that's harsh. You think about tackling racism with just text, and that's just doesn't get you the same level of engagement. And then you have something like Superman Smashes the Klan, and you can just see people light up when they see something like this, whether it's the art, the lettering, the writing, the panels, everything. And again, I think what is awesome is that I guess a lot of authors, smart authors, always manage to weave in their personal stories together with the stories of the people that I guess inspired the originals, right towards the back of these origin stories, I guess, if you want to call them that, at the back of the graphic novel. So I typically, when I'm shopping at a bookstore, and by the way, I missed that. Thank you, Corona, for taking that away from me, is walking up to those bookstores and just browsing and reading the backs of these books and figuring out what we're going to get stuck into next. But I can't wait to get my teeth sunk into They Called Us Enemy. So thank you, Michael, again, for recommending that. And this has been an absolute, absolute pleasure having you on the show. I'm so excited for you for the next conference, and by that I mean our podcast, we'd love to see if we can help in any which way that we can, whether it's raising awareness of the event to actually hopefully being out there, being with you to celebrate it. So please accept our deepest condolences on the loss of your colleague as well. Clearly she had a lot to do with this, and I guess that should not be forgotten.
Yeah, Jen was an amazing teacher, if I may. She ushered in so many young teachers. She did the job of being that last professor during the student teacher process, the teacher training process. I was among the first group that she taught when she came to the college, and she taught for many years. And so she put out so many kids, young teachers, out into the world, into the teaching world. And it's really the biggest loss. I mean, we all lost something when she passed away, but I've always felt like the biggest loss was to education in general, because she's not there to put more teachers out. Like, she could have had so much more of an impact and influenced so many young teachers' lives. I don't know a single one of her students that ever said anything but wonderful things about her manner and her lessons. And she was just, if you Google Dr. Jennifer Cook, Rhode Island College, you'll find videos of her talking about teaching and writing and the process of being an educator. And it's really something to remember. So, she left a lot of people behind, family and friends and students. So I genuinely appreciate that you gave me the chance to talk about her today.
Michael, thank you again. Thanks for being with us and for educating us on the importance of graphic novels in education, and most particularly about this very, very important story around how Superman smashes the Klan. Just two very quick things before we sign off. One is, were you aware that DC actually also launched a comic book with Batman in it around, and I think I'm just looking up my records. It was the Detective Comics, and it was in 1989, where Batman was basically shown facing off with the Klan. So I haven't read it, but I am a big fan of this whole Japanese Batman, and certainly Netflix has turned that around and made it a very popular sort of Japanime. But I think Batman, again, being the superhero that he was, fighting the Klan sounds like an interesting one to pick up next, perhaps also. And on the last sort of closing note, why is it that your Twitter handle is called Trying Teacher? Because from the sound of it, you're doing a hell lot more than just trying.
I think it sounded cool at the time, and the comics teacher and teaching comics and all the, those kinds of handles were already kind of taken.
Sure.
So I thought I would kind of. And there was so many people that have comics and teacher in their Twitter handle. I didn't want to get lost in the mess of that. And kind of like, you know, some of my closest friends, members of my cohort, actually have the comics teacher or comics teacher as their Twitter handle. So, I mean, this was before I met them that I created. I just thought back then when I started it, I was still trying to figure it out, like how to be a good teacher. And I still am. I think all good teachers are always trying to figure out how to be a good teacher. Pushing yourself and trying. I'm always trying to learn more and trying to make an impact and trying to help my students, trying to support my colleagues and trying to be part of my community. So I'm trying.
You're doing a hell of a lot more than just that. Thank you, Michael, and wishing you safe journey, safe travels, and hopefully a lot of fun with your students in the coming weeks and months ahead. Keep us posted on what you're reading next. Thanks, Michael. Speak soon.
Thank you. Thank you so much.
Cheers.